Welcome to the latest episode of Your Wealth with Gemma Dell, a podcast series designed to help you create, grow, and protect your wealth.
Hi, I'm Gemma Dale, NAB Trade's Director of SMSF and Investor Behaviour. Today I'm talking with a fund manager who specialises in small to mid-cap stocks that are primarily based in Western Australia. That's quite a niche, but it's a valuable one in that WA has some exceptional opportunities in the energy and materials sector, which are often quite difficult to navigate for those, including myself, who don't have any specialist expertise in those fields. My guest today is Dermot Woods of West Oz Funds Management. Dermot, thanks so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me. Very good to be here.
So, Dermot, you don't sound like a native West Australian. What brought you to this part of the world? How did you get interested in WA as an investment opportunity?
Well, it's a relatively long story, but I'll try and shorten it down. I worked in London and Dublin after university. I'm originally from Northern Ireland, but I left there when I went to university in Edinburgh. And at about 30 years old, I decided I wanted to live somewhere with a bit more lifestyle benefit to it than Dublin, where I was at the time. And my two thoughts were Vancouver and Sydney. Now, Vancouver shows a certain lack of research, which I'm not proud about because it rains there quite a lot. And having spent the first 30 years of my life in Ireland and the UK, I'd had enough rain. So I came to Sydney, and that happily coincided with the 2003 Rugby World Cup. So I watched a lot of that, but I sort of realised Sydney, whilst it's beautiful, it had a lot of the aspects to London, which I didn't particularly love. And I was probably going back to Ireland or the UK with my tail between my legs. And I stopped off in WA and had some relatives there, and I met a few people and started playing rugby there. And one thing led to another, and I ended up with a job with Ural Securities, which is the sort of sister broking firm to our funds management company. They're both owned by the same head company, Ural's Limited. And subsequent to that, Euros Limited started West Oz Funds Management, and I moved across there in January 2007. So a love affair with resources started then.
Oh, so your timing was pretty much perfect then. You were in the thick of it.
Yeah, I guess, you know, I like to say, you know, timing isn't everything. It's the only thing. And so we actually launched the first of our listed investment companies in mid-2005, and that was fairly perfect timing. The resources construction boom was just really ramping up in earnest, so the first couple of years were very beneficial, and that's very important actually for a listed investment company, because you start off with a good runway and you can generate profit reserves and generate dividends and franking credits to carry you through the times, which will be, you know, there'll be good times and not so good times.
It's in that rather cyclical world that you're in.
Yep.
So I will clarify up front, because I've made this mistake already. WA is a resource paradise, but you do invest in other things. We often get queries from our investors about the outlook for resources generally, specific minerals in particular. It seems like there's some trendy stuff every sort of 12 months or so. Given your focus outside the large cap universe, how do you do your research?
Well, we're fundamentally based and fundamental research based. And what does that mean? Well, we're not technical. We don't look at charts and decide what to buy. We don't look at momentum in the stock market and decide what to buy. And we don't have a black box which uses algorithms to spit out investments. So what we do is we go to visit company management, we go to visit the assets, and we research the companies in a lot of detail and research the finances in a lot of detail in particular. So our process for resource companies isn't really any different than our process for industrial companies. Just the assets tend to be quite different in nature, in that the main asset is underground.
Yes, literally.
And you can't see it. So we run through a process when we invest in any company. We look at the people, we look at the cash flow potential of the asset. We look at the capital structure, and we look at the valuation. It's a very simple way to go about things, but you know, the complexities in the detail. Obviously, so people in resource companies are very important, because these things can take a while to happen. So the first thing we look for is somebody who's been there and done it before, because you want somebody with the experience to go through the tough times, because there will be tough times of some sort when you're trying to get one of these assets off the ground. It's never really, or out of the ground, it's never really plain sailing. And we also look for people who are preferably, they've made some money in the past through successful ventures, and they're reinvesting that money again, because that's very important when it comes to some other points that we look for in companies we invest in. But I guess that, you know, the cash flow potential of the asset is probably the thing that people are most interested in how we analyse and what we look for and don't look for in that. And really, it's the KISS principle, you know, keep it simple, stupid. And with resources, the first thing is grade is king. But, you know, a very close second grade in my mind is geometry.
So talk to us about how grade is king and what that means for people. So for a complete novice, yeah. what do you mean by that?
Well, you know, it's quite simple. If you've got, take iron ore as an example, because that's been a very sort of recent divorces in prices there. They're worth talking about. If you've got 58% iron ore, that means it's 58% of the ton of dirt you're taking out of the ground is iron ore. Well, that doesn't fetch the same price as 62% iron ore, which is the benchmark. And so each ton you process, if you're processing 62% ton, you're getting more bang for your buck in terms of processing. It costs roughly the same amount to get it out of the ground and chuck it through the plant. If you need to, and you know, the same applies for gold or copper or whatever asset you're digging out of the ground.
Nice. And so you're talking next about geometry.
Yes. And that's something I think that tends to get overlooked by a lot of investors, and quite often, especially with site gold companies when we're looking at them, I look for what they're not saying. And quite often what they're not saying is what the strip ratio of the ore body is. So something sounds very, very nice. They've got 2 million ounces at, you know, 1.5, 2 grams a ton, and that's an ore body, depending on how much other dirt you have to shift. So the strip ratio is the ratio of waste that you have to move to the ore that you get out of the ground, and the ore is the stuff that you want, obviously. But if that strip ratio is too high, you don't have an ore body, you've just got, you know, a lump of rock.
Your bucket load of dirt.
Yeah.
Many bucket loads of dirt.
Mm. Yeah, it doesn't mean you can't make money, but it's important, you know, how much of Mother Earth is between those ore resources. Yeah. And equally, if you've got an underground ore body, you know, you'd rather have something that's vertical and easy to mine, rather than something that's more flat lying, because that's going to be more complex and cost more to mine, get out of the ground.
As a retail investor, so the vast majority of people listening to this will be retail investors, how well equipped do you think they are to getting access to that sort of information and understanding that sort of stuff? Is it well publicised? Do you kind of have to read between the lines, or do you feel it's the sort of thing where you need to get out there and see it?
I think ultimately, when a company gets towards the stage of developing a project, so it's called a definitive feasibility study, all of that will be unveiled. But I mean, the devil's always in the detail with those things. Companies are seeking financing at that stage, and it's a game with the markets. They disclose what they have to disclose, but obviously they want to get the capital for the greatest price possible. And so the devil is in the detail, but it is there. There's quite strict disclosure requirements. You just have to know where to go looking for it. And the other thing we pay a lot of attention to is, when is that cash flow coming? And, you know, is it front-ended? Is it back-ended? How much commodity price risk are we taking off? If the price of iron ore is $100 today, and you've got a beautiful life of mine cost of $60, does that life of mine cost vary dramatically over the mine life? Is it front-ended? Is it back-ended? And that's very important, because obviously you'd rather pay back your money quickly.
We do all of our budget updates whenever the federal government releases all of their plans for the coming 12 months and their view on the economy and so on. And it was quite entertaining this year to pull up our chart from last year, where the iron ore price is factored in at $55.
Yeah.
And it was a beautiful looking budget, right? We're going to be back to surplus at some point in the future. And you're thinking, you strip out that price back to $55 and it doesn't look quite so pretty. When you change your assumptions, everything looks very different.
No, I've also had a view as well, state and federal governments should have a baseline price in their model, and everything else goes into a fund, an infrastructure fund or something, not into a recurring expenditure budget, which we saw in WA and grand style in the last 10 or 15 years.
And then it's not there again when everything changes.
Same with stamp duty, probably.
Yeah, well, goodness, I'm finding that one in New South Wales and Victoria at the moment. So WA was very much the epicentre of the mining boom in Australia. It's really moderated over the last few years. What's your sort of macro view of opportunities for investors who are interested in resources? We've seen Fortescue's come back so hard, and you know, no one was interested 12 months ago. We weren't even talking about it. And suddenly all of our investors are all over it, even when the price gets a bit heady.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts about investors, about where it fits in the portfolio and how they should look at it?
Well, I think it's like any sector. There's pockets of overvaluation and pockets of undervaluation. You look to where all the capital's heading. That's probably where the overvaluation is residing. You look to where it's getting no capital, and that's probably where the undervaluation is residing. So a very simple example in Australian terms, because it's relatively topical given the low Aussie dollar. We think Aussie dollar gold stocks are, and by Aussie dollar gold stocks, I mean gold companies that have their mines in Australia, so all their operating costs are in Australian dollars, whereas they're selling gold in US dollars, so a tremendous margin there at the moment. But we think you're paying an extraordinary price for it. And when you look at the actual free cash flow of these operations and then compare that to what they're valued at on the stock market, I mean, never the twain shall meet. Those things are never going to make sense unless the gold price goes to some level none of us have predicted. And if that happens, we think offshore gold assets look like far better value because investors just aren't particularly interested in them at the moment. And so we have one company called West African Resources in our portfolio that's midway through developing an asset in Burkina Faso. And you know, if that was listed in Australia, it's not, granted. It would have a market cap that was many multiples of its current one. You know, and at the end of the day, if they get the gold or the ground for the cost they say they will and sell it at the current gold price, they'll be making, you know, a tremendous amount of free cash, and then the market will revalue it upwards accordingly. And we're always of a mind to look where absolute consensus opinion is, and one place at the moment is a, you know, forever declining Aussie dollar. And no, God forgive, that could go the other way. I don't think the market's set up for it, so it probably doesn't hurt to have some insurance in your portfolio for that, given that the vast majority of other resource companies we're investing in will, you know, have a positive impact of a lower Aussie.
I was going to ask you where are your preferred areas of focus at the moment. Yeah. So definitely not Australian dollar gold stocks, got that.
No. I mean, they're going terrifically well at the moment, and hence why they've got terrific valuations. But we do very much focus on the actual free cash flow that comes out of these operations, rather than the difference between the Aussie dollar, current Aussie dollar gold price, and their declared all-in sustaining costs. Because we tend to find there can be quite a lot of difference between the sort of the margin on the face of it and the actual cash flow margin. So what do we find interesting at the moment? Well, we've been investing in base metal stocks lately. We think that's going to be really interesting as electric vehicle usage really builds up, nickel in particular, because nickel and nickel sulfide ore bodies, which is what you need for nickel sulfate, which is a element that goes into battery manufacture, and they're very, very difficult to find. And the incentive price needed to bring new nickel ore bodies online is vastly in excess of what we have at the moment. You know, that's what happened in lithium. Lithium was a different situation, because in lithium we went in with an absolute supply shock, whereas the biggest hard rock in the mine in the world is in Greenbushes and in the south of Western Australia. And it gets very little commentary, but it took all its supply in-house. So there was a mad scramble to get more supply for that hard rock spodumene that mine produced. And now we've got a lot of other mines in Western Australia coming online at sort of half the grade of that mine, for example.
You made some comments about lithium in general, about how easy it is to find relative to nickel. I thought it was quite.
Well, yeah, it's more of a bulk than a metal. So, you know, by definition, a bulk by definition is easier to find. It doesn't mean it's easier to make money out of it. And you know, we were fairly wary on the lithium market as it took off last year. We sort of believed there's usually a voyage of discovery in these opaque commodities. We far prefer the things that trade on market, like gold and copper and oil. For example, we find the opaque commodities, there's usually a big voyage of discovery for the market. And how do you sell it in the first place? Who do you sell it to? How reliable are they? How easy is it to process it, to get it out of the ground? And I think we're a long way through that journey. In lithium, I don't think we're quite at the end of it yet, but I do think it's, you know, now is the time to do the work. These won't be here and gone, I don't think. They won't be like hematite and iron ore mines, where there's not quite the same requirement to have them. There's an absolute requirement to have these mines, and I think it's going to be, you know, they're going to be here to stay. So that's something we're doing the work on at the moment. But think maybe we're one or two steps away.
The supply chain questions are really interesting at the moment.
Yes.
So there's this issue about trendy stuff.
Yeah.
People living in Sydney who've never seen a mine in their lives suddenly hearing that lithium's really important, just buying anything with lithium in the title.
Well, they've won so far. So. Well done.
I mean, they've had a good year or two, right? It's been lovely. And the trends seem to offer opportunity. But supply chain issues are suddenly coming to the fore and making people think long and hard about where they put their money. So trade tensions are obviously front and centre for plenty of people thinking about where the next big opportunity might lie.
Yeah, and that definitely has happened to some extent in the resources market. And lithium is a very good example of that. So there's currently at least two processing plants under construction in WA for billions of dollars. And they'd be far, far cheaper to build in China. But the world wants ex-Chinese supply of these battery materials. Because up until very recently, in lithium, the vast, vast majority of secondary processing was done in China. In graphite, all the secondary processing is done in China. And in rare earths, again, we saw the Japanese come in and fund a rare earth project in Australia, even though they knew that was going to be a long journey. And they did the same thing with Ora Cobra in the lithium space. So that certainly is the trend that's here to stay. And as you allude to, current trade negotiations will probably accelerate it somewhat.
It is. It's really interesting. I think certainly for investors, they're looking for disruptions to the supply chain and whether or not there's opportunities offshore and somewhere else to go. Do you think these trendy or sort of news orientated? Because these are really difficult to navigate, right? The news changes every day.
Yeah.
It's hilarious when I open my emails in the morning and they're like, it's risk on! Next morning, it's risk off! We've all changed our minds again because Trump tweeted something or other, and we've decided today it's going to affect rare earths or whatever it is that we've decided it's going to affect. Do you think Australia's going to be affected dramatically if the trade wars do escalate? Do you think these are going to become mega trends that we need to be really conscious of, or do you think perhaps it will be BAU?
There's two questions there.
Sorry.
I think the simple one is, will Australia be affected if the trade wars escalate? Mm-hmm. Yes. Trade wars will escalate. Global corporate confidence will go down, and therefore trade will decrease, and that's not good for Australia. I mean, there's no way around that. I mean, the optimistic point of view is it's a negotiation process, and we're probably at the point of maximum uncertainty, and the markets hate uncertainty. So as we get more certainty, that will probably be a good thing. And are some of these megatrends here to stay? Well, yes. I think cleaner energy is one of the more exciting things I've seen in the market. Probably the birth of and use and monetization of the internet was probably the most exciting thing I've ever seen, but I think clean energy runs a pretty close second to maybe big data in terms of things that are going to keep on trucking for the next 20 years or something.
Interesting then, if the trade tensions, obviously Australia will be, we're in an interesting situation with two of our biggest trading partners going head to head. But to your point about processing plants being built in Australia rather than China, there may be some more beneficial outcomes than we fear.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's certainly been a positive benefit, but I think that was happening. I guess it is tied up with trade wars, but it's sort of coincidental to the trade war rather than as a result of it. But that was probably a future trade war foreseen.
Mm. Another one.
And not wanting to be held to ransom by one particular country or be starved of supply.
Mm.
And it was interesting. I went to China around the time that the Greenbushes mine was bringing supply sort of in-house to its own supply chain, and there was proper panic from secondary processors there that they wouldn't have a source of supply. So that's why the lithium price skyrocketed, because they had to incentivize other people to produce for them. But once you get past the tipping point in terms of demand supply, that price will come back to economic reality, and history tells us sometimes below that for a while.
So you're a proud West Australian now.
Yep.
Very proud. Most East Australians tend to see WA, and you've made this comment yourself, it's quite a boom and bust state.
Oh, I don't think I've ever said boom and bust.
Cyclical.
I prefer cyclical.
That's much kinder. I'm from Queensland, and there's certainly areas of Queensland that get a little bit boom and busty. What other opportunities should investors be looking for in
WA? Well, I think we don't shy. we can't shy away from the fact that the WA is a more cyclical state than, you know, as is Queensland, for example. You know, I thought it was very amusing after the election result when some of the more left-leaning aspects of society thought, "Oh, we'll just cast Queensland adrift." Queensland. Queensland and WA drift, and
let them go,
and everything everything will be okay. Well, you probably wouldn't want to look at your current account or your trade deficit account, as you would now have if that happened. But WA is cyclical, but we're at the bottom of the cycle. That's, you know, it's probably been 5 years of negative domestic demand growth in WA, and you know, what looks particularly exciting coming out of the back of that? Well, anything really related to construction, because we're at the absolute bottom of the residential market. And the resources construction market in WA, and the knock-on effect there is the property market in WA. And if you look at the affordability statistics, there's a lot of room for WA property to move pretty quickly once confidence builds up in the job market, and maybe, you know, maybe some wage growth if it ever eventuates. You know, so we're trading at WA property is about 5.2 times, somewhere around that, household income. I think here in New South Wales, you're at 8.6 or 8.4.
We've been well above 10 at various points, yep.
And Melbourne, 7.5 times or something. So there's a lot of room to gallop up there pretty quickly. And the other interesting factor is interest rates are now set for an economy and a property market in Victoria and New South Wales that is very much coming off the boil, but they're national interest rates. So if the WA economy is turning around at the same point in time, you get to a point where you probably should have higher interest rates, but that's when property can really skyrocket. And I saw that happen when I first moved to Western Australia, and prior to that I saw it happen in Ireland for 10 years as they had interest rates set for basically the German industrial base rather than the tiger economy in Ireland at the time, and property went nuts.
Absolutely mental, and everybody owned three
yeah, Bulgarian apartments.
Yeah, beautiful. Dummett, you presented at the ASX Investor Days and the Advisor Days in Adelaide and Perth in recent weeks. You had some thoughts for investors about LICs that I thought were really interesting and worth, you know, many of our investors hold LICs. They've got plenty of thoughts about that structure and where it currently sits. Could you share those with us?
Yeah, I think it really comes from the fact that when I get out of markets, I know how hard it is to work in markets and invest in stocks. You know, it's a tricky game, and I certainly won't be doing it when I'm not doing it full time myself. So where will I put my money? Well, I'll put it into listed investment companies or exchange traded funds, because they're very easy to transact. You know, and at the moment I think listed investment companies are very attractively priced, and there's a couple of very simple reasons for that. I mean, firstly, there's effectively a buyer strike up until the election due to the threatened removal of cash refunds by the Labour Party. And we know from talking to our own shareholders over the preceding 6 months that they were just sitting on their hands and letting cash build up in their portfolios because they felt exposed. And so it's fantastic that that's gone away. But there's the old saying, you know, you climb the stairs with share prices and you go down the elevator. And that's sort of gone down the elevator a bit in the liquid world, and we're currently climbing the stairs again. Elevator's probably a bit harsh for the listed investment company world. There's not quite that much sex and violence in it. but the result is there's a lot of the discounts to net asset value. So the share price, the price that these funds trade on the market, is at bigger discounts than normal to the net asset values. And you know, I'm not so much pushing my own investment company here. We trade about a 9% discount at the moment. But we've been actually fairly steady in terms of discount through this period. A lot of others have blown out to sort of 50. And there's a lot of good fund managers at 10 to 25% discounts, and they're quite undeserved. And the other point is, quite often a fund or a listed investment company will trade at its biggest discount at its worst moment in time. So then when it's on its way back up again, you get sort of double whammy of the discount closing in and more profitability in your fund. But very possible to make up a very healthy portfolio of diversified funds run by quality managers at, you know, a 10% discount plus at the moment. So I really think investors should be looking at it.
Yeah, it's quite interesting to look at the moment, some of the...
Yeah.
You quite happily buy a lot of other things at a discount, but investors have been quite nervous for a while now.
Yeah, and the point is, you know, compared to some of the other stuff that we're talking about, you know, which is towards the pointy end of the spectrum, listed investment companies carry no debt, typically, you know, and you know have franking credits and have assets that are there to stay. They're very stable. They're a very stable investment.
Yeah, and you've got that sort of inherent diversification, so you're covering a wide range of stocks and you've got a professional managing for you and all those things, which should also be true, the professional manager of the company, but still, we see some interesting things.
Yeah.
Dermot, thank you so much for your time today.
Pleasure.
You publish regular videos and updates. Where can people go to keep up to date with your thoughts on your portfolio and other opportunities in the market?
Oh, well, our website's definitely the best place to go, westallsfunds.com.au. All our contact details are on there for the whole team. We love talking to investors. You know, we more frequently get calls from investors nowadays and very much enjoy that.
And West Oz is with an OZ.
Yes.
So yeah, West OZ.
Yes.
Rather than looking up the AUS.
I'm forever doing that
on
the phone.
It's not there. Yeah.
Yeah.
Dermot, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me, Dermot.
And thank you so much for listening also. As always, we hope this episode has been helpful for you on your journey to creating wealth. If you have any feedback or suggestions for future topics, this topic came from an email from a listener. We do love to hear from you, so please just email us at yourwealth@nab.com.au. I'm Gemma Dale. Thanks for joining me.
Thank you for listening to Your Wealth with Gemma Dale. To stay up to date, please subscribe to this podcast series or email us at yourwealth@nab.com.au.
Please note that any advice provided in this podcast has been prepared without taking into account your objectives, financial circumstances, or needs. Before acting, you should consider the appropriateness of the information. To find out more, please visit nab.com.au.